part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
Here we go. This is a part-time fanboy, and this is our Mad Max Fury Road episode. I am Christian Horn, and I am here with my partner in crime, Paul Edwards. And
I live, I die, I live again.
we are here to discuss. I don't think not only Fury Road, but the whole Mad Max shebang.
Why not, man? Let's do the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah, because I actually have gone back and watched all three, you know, at this point. And
I went back and watched all of them except for Thunderdome.
Oh, I just saw Thunderdome this past weekend.
And that's the only one that I don't own.
Oh,
so
really?
That's why I haven't watched it.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's just really weird because... I mean, I like all of these movies. I think they're all fantastic. But this last one, Fury Road, you know, it just blew my effing socks off. Like, I couldn't believe how much I enjoyed that movie.
Well, it's so awesome to see a movie that's just, like, made for, like, the theater. It's made for the big screen.
Yeah.
It is made to be spectacle, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's there to present a huge, crazy idea, you know, and it's so well done. I just don't think that people were expecting it to be as good as it was.
No, I mean, that's the thing, is like, it's almost like a completely new brand of filmmaking. Like, it to me, this was the most impressive action movie that or the best experience I've had in a movie theater since I've seen the original Matrix. Like, that's how impressed I was with this, because I mean, this doesn't revolutionize effects or anything like the Matrix did, but it really, I mean, editing and just like design and just, you know, it's like a roller coaster. Like, really wish that all action movies were like this, because I mean, it's incredible, you know. I mean, I was just from the opening scene. You have that scene where Tom Hardy, Mad Max, is sort of like, you know, and spoilers for anyone listening, the movie's been out like 3 weeks already, so you know, we're running behind.
And if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, go see this movie now. What are you wasting your time for, listening to us? Go see this
exactly.
movie.
Go see this movie. It's one of the best movies, I think, in the past like 10 years, you know. I was astounded, and just because, you know, I had watched The Road Warrior the night before I went to go see it, and I'd seen the original Mad Max several months before that, like on Turner Classic Movies. Mm-hmm. They show it every once in a while, but seeing The Road Warrior the night before, it's really funny how it kind of set me up for not, like you were saying, like not expecting like this to be as crazy as it was, because The Road Warrior is like, it's a really solid film, and for the time that it came out, you know, it was a really hardcore sort of like action film. Like, nobody had really seen anything like that before, but it's very, I mean, for today's audience, is it's very sort of standard, you know, even though it kind of like trailblazed like what it did like for today. So it kind of like put me in a frame of mind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to get more of this, you know what I mean?
Right.
But this was like this on like crack and heroin and like a speedball, like all mixed into one, you know what
there,
I mean?
There's been a lot of advancement in motion picture technology since then. And the thing that I think a lot of people forget is that the director, George Miller, who has directed all of them, he's been working with this sort of state-of-the-art technology for a long time, but he's been doing kids' movies. You know,
yeah.
He's been doing Babe. He's been doing Happy Feet. He hasn't directed an action movie in a long time.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, to see him do a live-action action movie with all of the new technology at his disposal was just truly something. It's really impressive. He went back and worked with the DP John Seale, who he worked with back in Lorenzo's Oil, 1992, who sort of...
And apparently he was up for Road Warrior, like way back in the day.
Oh, yeah,
and he didn't get it, yeah.
But, you know, John Seale is sort of... He has a really beautiful visual style and...
He does.
Loves to... move the camera, and you know, this movie like just moves so much. And what I really love about it too is the fact that, like, yeah, it's been out for 3 weeks, people are still talking about this movie. I mean, you still look at like the list of like podcasts and things out there, people are talking about this movie and going back to see it, you know, again and again and again. And it really does hold up so well. It holds up under, you know, study, and it just holds up as a great like experience. I went to see it twice, and you know, the second time was just as enjoyable, if not more, than the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm dying to see it again. I've only seen it once, and part of the reason I kind of like held back on doing this podcast is because I needed time to see the first three again, because I really wanted to sort of get like a frame of reference, you know, where these movies have been, where they've gone, and you know, where this one, you know, has taken us, you know what I mean? Because each time, I would say, like, with the exception of Thunderdome, I would say like each one has really sort of like advanced, you know, indie movies or action movies, or you know, the first Mad Max, like foreign films, you know, were expected to be sort of stuffy, cerebral things, and you know, along comes this like freaking car chase movie that's absolutely crazy, set in the apocalypse, like Soylent Green kind of world, you know
right.
what I mean? And you know, it blew people's minds back then. And then, you know, he decided a couple years later, he gets to do the Road Warrior, you know, and, you know, that just blows people's minds again, right? And
yeah,
and it's just like, it just keeps going.
Let's talk about Mad Max. We'll go back to the first one and bring ourselves up to Fury Road.
Sure.
The first one was, you know, a super duper low budget movie.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was, it's part of the, I guess they're, you know, they're sort of categorizing it in a movement now, the Ozploitation.
Movies,
you know, that it was these movies that were just generally like sort of action movies, exploitation movies that came out of Australia. And it featured Mel Gibson in his first, you know, first role, although in America, he was dubbed over by an American-accented person.
Well, they did release it in the States, and then a lot of people found it to be, like, really confusing. So I think they came out with the second version that was dubbed. I could be wrong about that. But I think, like, a lot of the Australian, you know, the accents were so thick. I know that when I... watched it on Turner Classic Movies, they showed obviously the original Australian accents, mm-hmm. and I had to turn on the hearing impaired stuff in some scenes because I was like, I have no idea what that guy just said. And I found myself...
Are you like, talking about like the police captain?
Yeah, well, just like a lot of people too, just the police captain especially, but a lot of people just in the movie would say stuff and or be yelling or whatever, and it would be like in this accent, and I'm like, I have no... Or using like slang, you know what I'm saying, where I'm like, I have no idea what that guy just said.
Right.
So, well, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
You know, the first Mad Max movie is definitely the, you know, sort of the low budget, you know, genesis of everything.
Absolutely.
In terms of the where, like, sort of when it happens, it sort of happens pre-apocalypse. It's sort of, you
like
know,
like
now we talk about, you know, the post-apocalyptic world. See, I'd say that this is like the pre-apocalyptic world, you
I
know?
I would say like in the midst of the, like, things are falling apart,
Are falling apart, but, you know, people are doing their best to try to hold it all together.
Yeah,
And, you know, you're introduced to, you know, Max, who is the what would you call him? I mean, it's like he's a police officer.
Well, they're cops. They're pretty much cops.
But really, they're just sort of there to try to break up these, you know, roving motorcycle gangs that have sort of taken over the roads and are terrorizing everybody in, I guess, sort of rural Australia.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is like society's falling apart and they barely even have a station. Like they're like the last vestiges of like organization, you know, of right. this type of thing existing in this particular place in the world. And you sort of get the idea that this sort of thing is happening everywhere. I mean, you know, it sort of reminded me a little bit of like RoboCop, where right. it's like, you know, the police force is being swallowed up by a corporation, but in this case, like, there's the, you know, the basically like public utilities or whatever, everything's kind of falling apart, although right. there is still a hospital that people go to.
Well, and what's great too is that he's got a partner named Goose, you know, which is like before Top Gun at all, you know, but Max and his partner Goose are sort of like they're on this team that are breaking up these motorcycle gangs.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, it's sort of early on in the movie, they give Max this this car, you know, they're talking about this car. This car's got a V8 engine.
Yeah,
you know,
sort of which, like a James Bond, you know, like Q sort of scene where.
Right, so it's gonna make it like, you know, it's like the baddest ass car on the road, you know. And you know, and if you understand Australian car culture, you know, I mean, like, they I love ice cream, like, but like they fucking love cars, you know, more than anything. And a V8 is just, you know, it's like the Holy Grail. But you know, basically this gang ends up you know, killing Goose, or turning him into, you know,
they arrest it's not Toe Cutter, it's the other guy, right? It's the Knight Rider, right?
That's right. Yeah. They arrest the Knight Rider, who's a member of this gang, and Toe Cutter, who's the leader of the gang.
Yes.
And you know, his guys are basically, you know, just sort of, you know, destroying rural Australia. Running through, they're stealing gasoline, they're raping people, like they're just like horrible.
Well, they're essentially that villain that sort of appears like late 70s, early 80s, sort of like Dirty Harry, you know,
right.
Death Wish, like these totally unredeemable madmen, like, you know, scum that everyone was afraid of at the time. And, you know, and it's really funny because, the arrest of, or is it the death or arrest of the Knight Rider? It's, like I said, it's been a couple of months, but whatever happens to Knight Rider is what escalates sort of the action, like the competition between, you know, what the sort of biker jacket wearing cops,
right,
and the motorcycle gang. And it's really weird because they are almost like gangs, like, you know, mm-hmm. in their own way. So
right, it's almost like a gang versus gang kind of thing. It's just that, you know, one of the people, you know, one of the gangs is marginally more on the side of humanity than the other gang. But, you know, basically what happens is that, you know, Goose just sort of can't handle the fact that this gang is, you know, running around and everything, and they go after him. They basically burn him near to death, and, you know, Max is extremely sort of destroyed by this, and you know, tries to get away. He takes his wife, takes their kid, his little son,
done.
And like he's just done. He hangs it up and like runs sort of into the even more rural countryside, but the gang follows him. They kill his family, and this just drives him completely mad.
He goes over the edge. Yes,
and he, you know, does his, you know, comes back, takes the car, and goes after the gang, and, you know, pretty much destroys them, but pretty much himself in the process. That's one of the things about Mad Max, is that he's one of those characters that just takes a lot of punishment. I mean, like, does anything ever go right for him?
Well, that's the thing, and this is the thing we talk about, you know, once you get to Road Warrior, you really see this, is that he makes a lot of bad decisions, dude. And that that is, and he does the same thing in Fury Road. He does a lot of, you know, stupid things, you know, where it's like, you sure you really want to go through with that plan? You know what I'm saying? Like, the thing about Max in these movies is I feel that he is cunning, but I don't think that he's the brightest bulb on the sign, which is why I like the character, you know what I mean? Because he's not perfect. And in all three of the movies, like Mad Max, Road Warrior, Beyond Thunderdome, he does a lot of, like, a little less in Beyond Thunderdome, though, I think, because at that time, like, Mel Gibson had become, like, the Mel Gibson star, you know? So the character had to be a little less flawed. But I think, like, particularly in Mad Max Road Warrior, Mad Max 2, he makes a lot of stupid mistakes.
And one of the other things, too, is that, like, he's one of those people whose humanity always gets the best of him.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's true. Which leads to making some of those stupid mistakes, quite honestly. You know what I mean?
You know, at the end of the movie, at the end of the first Mad Max is sort of an infamous movie. It's been copied time and time again.
The Watchmen.
He gets the last, you know, the last member of the gang.
Yep.
You know, he handcuffs him to this burning vehicle.
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, throws him a saw and basically says, you know, you've got the choice of either sawing through the handcuffs, which is going to take 10 minutes, or you saw through your, you know, saw the hand or ankle. Like, say, he's like, basically, saw through yourself, it'll take 5.
Yep.
You know, and he starts begging, walks away. Thing blows off, you know, thing blows up behind him.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't matter anyway, but, like, you know, it's basically him kissing his humanity completely goodbye.
Yeah.
And he just disappears into the desert.
Yeah. Which is a scene that Rorschach, they stole for Rorschach, or Alan Moore co-opted for The Watchmen. You know,
they
what
made
I
a
mean?
Whole fucking film series out of it with Saw.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, it's a great moment, and, like, it shows you how far gone this guy is. He's lost everything, and he just doesn't care anymore.
Yeah, and in this one, in the first Mad Max, there's definitely, like, an arc there. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think there's, like, they don't really get deep into, like, Mel Gibson's character. Obviously, this is an indie movie. I think it's definitely more focused on setting up the environment, and you know, there's some crazy edits. You can see that it's limited by a little bit of its production value. But in this movie, I think that this is the one where he goes through the biggest arc from, like, I start here and I go and I end up here. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah, he starts off as, you know, the family man who's out there to do the right thing, and ends up as basically something with a person with no one, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he just turns into, like, without, they always call him in the movies a shell of a man, you know.
Yeah.
This is the movie where you just see every little bit of humanity in him get burned out. And I mean, it's a dark fucking movie.
It is.
And, you know, but it's so well shot, too. I mean, like, the scene, I think probably the best scene in it is the scene where his wife and child are killed.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Because the motorcycles are, you know, revving up their engines, and she grabs the child, and she's just running down the road.
Yep.
And, you know, the kid's been holding, he's been playing with this ball, you know, the whole time, this little red ball. And you just hear the rev of the motorcycles and see them go by, and then you just see the ball bounce down the road.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really understated, but
you get,
you know,
it.
You get it, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, Gibson really does sell.
Yeah, he's,
like,
really good in this.
You know, you really buy the fact that, yeah, he loves his wife, you know.
Yeah.
And he wants a better world, but the better world's not coming.
Well, that's the thing about Mel Gibson. And, you know, Mel Gibson, you know, whatever, he's gone crazy. And, you know, that's the thing, is I was watching Road Warrior with my wife, and we were kind of sitting there, and, you know, I was like, wow, you know, he was a handsome guy. Like, he was good looking. He had presence. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you get, like, why he became, like, Mel Gibson, right?
Right,
and,
right.
But then I turned to my wife, and I'm sort of like, do you think he was always crazy, or do you think he went crazy? crazy. And she's like, I think he went crazy. She's like, I think he probably, the stardom, you know, that it's just got to blow your mind. You know what I mean? Like all the hoops that you got to jump through and how famous you are and who knows.
Well, the funny thing about, you know, about this movie, I mean, this was like a super low budget movie.
Yeah.
You know, George Miller was an ER doctor before he became.
Oh, I did not know that. Wow.
That was, as a matter of fact, like he had seen, like basically wrote this movie because of all the like car accidents that he had grown up seeing and patching up and everything. Like that really informed him, along with the fact that, like, you know, back in the 70s, you had the energy crisis going on. So he put this movie together and, you know, didn't have the money to fly the bikes or have the bikes shipped from Sydney to the location that they were shooting it at, out in a rural place. So the actors who were the motorcycle gang actually all rode the bikes together cross country to
great.
This place and basically became a motorcycle gang as they, you know, made their way over there.
That's great. Apparently Mel Gibson didn't even audition for this. Like
he went up with the guy with the, his friend was the guy who played Goose.
Went
into the auditions and Gibson had apparently been in like a bar fight the night before and was all swollen up and everything. But the casting people were like, oh, hey, you know, we need people who, you know, can look like that, you know?
Crazy. Yeah.
When he showed up later, they were like, just like, oh, wow, this, you know, this is our guy.
And, absolutely.
You know, the cars and the bikes in this movie are just so, you know, really like sort of characters in their own.
Yeah.
You know, for such a low budget movie, you know, everything definitely had like its own style. And that, which was really neat, and it was, and it just looked gorgeous because
it was one
of the first widescreen movies shot in Australia.
Well, you know what was interesting is that I think, like, to me, it watching, you know, especially the span over the first, you know, three movies, you see the hint of like, you know, things are customized. Nothing, there's not really a homogenized, you know, version of cars like you see today, like where it's all one design. Like this was definitely the beginnings of sort of like, you know, the cars being the big feature in the movie. You know what I mean? Because later on, the designs would just get, especially in this latest movie, Fury Road, they would just get crazy, like insane, which I appreciated. I was like, in Fury Road, I was just like, oh my God, like who built all these beautiful cars, like they're just so crazy. And I'm not even a car guy, but just you know, being really into like design and art and stuff like that, I was just so appreciative. And then, you know, same thing in the Road Warrior, right? So, you know, like the Road Warrior basically
let's move into Road Warrior. By the way, another great thing about Mad Max, which carried over into Road Warrior, the score, Brian May from Queen did the
it's a different Brian May. A lot of people make that mistake, but I made that mistake.
but really awesome score.
Great score. And one last thing about Mad Max is that the first time I saw Mad Max was on the day I either got my learner's permit or my driver's license. I went and I passed the test. I can't remember which one it was. And I don't know if it was on TV or I think I had rented it. Like somebody told me like it was a good movie. And for some reason, like coincidence of coincidences, I didn't rent it because I knew I was going on like my driver's test. Yeah. It's just like, I just was whatever. And I was like, wow, this is like a crazy driving movie. You know what I mean? So that was the first.
Tell me the truth. Like, did you take your instructor and like handcuff him to a burning car? You can give me my license.
It was after
5 minutes.
The test. I know. Can you imagine if I'd have watched that before the test?
That would be insane, man.
Yeah.
Let's go to Road Warrior, also known as Mad Max 2.
Yes, Mad Max 2.
Which skips ahead some amount of time.
I think it says, I looked it up, and I think that this Mad Max 2 occurs like a year after the original Mad Max or something like that. And then Beyond Thunderdome is 4 years after the Road Warrior. I'm not exactly positive about that, but yeah, I think
time starts to go really crazy in these movies, you know, because as everything sort of falls apart, time sort of becomes not important. You know, it's Mad Max 2 was definitely like sort of the breakthrough movie for Miller, because like it sort of managed to take all of these things that have been sort of floating around in the air, you know, like this was as Westerns were sort of just going out, you know, like you had like Pale Rider and a few of those things like that, but like the Westerns were sort of breathing their last gasp and everything. But then you've got all this, like you've got Punked, you've got you know, you've got the car thing, you've got the energy thing coming around again, you know, you've got the, you know, the 80s where you've got, you know, the threat of nuclear, you know, extermination constantly. Absolutely. And it's like, I think it sort of tapped into the same thing that the other Miller, Frank Miller, tapped into with Dark Knight.
Yeah.
You know, like these are two things that are coming sort of from the same bunch of influences. And when like this came out, like there had never been anything like it before.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. Like nothing like this had ever been done before, but you mentioned it before. Like the big thing that stuck out with me is Road Warrior, like Mad Max 2, is definitely the one where he becomes sort of like the man with no name, like you said.
Yeah.
Like, sort of like the Sergio Leone. There's a little bit of that influence. Like I love Sergio Leone Westerns. Like I love Once Upon a Time in the West and, you know, the Man with No Name. This is definitely the movie where it's like, I don't even know if he says his name in this movie.
No, dude. And like, literally, the dude has like 16 lines of dialogue in the movie, and more than half of them are like, "We had a deal."
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
Like, I mean, it's he says almost nothing in the movie. So when we're introduced to him in this one, he's now, you know, sort of in the, you know, in the outback, you know, scavenging, still has the car, you know, he still has what's left of the police uniform, but now he's got, you know, a dog who, you know, is like one of the most awesome, like, animals on film.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he's just scavenging gas. And it sort of sets up the pace for like all the movies. Like almost all of the movies now begin with him scavenging and there are people after him.
Yeah.
You know, and in this one, you know, he's introduced to another one of the roving gangs. This one is like the guy Wes, who's just like this like psychotic mohawked you know, warrior who is just
in,
you
chaps
know, like, yeah, just like a crazy figure.
Crazy,
you know?
Biker, scary. Like, really, really terrifying.
Yeah,
really
he
terrifying.
Really, really is scary. You know? He keeps this, like, you know, rent boy or whatever, you know, chained to his bike.
That's right.
And, you know, he just, you know, Max manages to get away from them, you know, as he's scavenging some gas from this old tanker truck, you know.
Well, he's being pursued, right? He finds a tanker truck, and then he finds the gyrocopter later on. He gets away from those guys,
right? And
he
also
meets the helicopter
guy. The first time where we meet, you know, the gyro captain guy.
Yes.
he's like Australian actor Bruce Spence, you know. And really, like, for the first three movies except for Tina Turner, you know, you've got pretty much all, you know, Australian actors.
That's true. That's really interesting.
And you
and
know,
the reason that she's in it is because Thunderdome was produced by an American studio.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But you know, the gyro captain's this guy who's got a working, you know, gyrocopter. You know, he's able to travel by air.
Yeah.
But you know, he's sort of this crazy little, you know, he's a little guy. You know.
Yeah.
He's a con guy.
He basically sets baits and traps and tries to, you know, get people to go for them. You know, and that's
right.
How Mel Gibson, Mad Max, gets sucked into like his little game. Right.
Right. And but you know, he manages to turn the tables on him.
Yeah.
Captures him, and to bargain for it, he's like, okay, okay, you know, let me out and I'll show you where you can get sort of as much gas as you want.
Yeah.
And basically leads him to this little refinery out in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
Where this small group of people are working, and they're essentially fortified this compound, and they're surrounded by the army of the Humongous.
The Humongous.
Who is like, imagine, like, you know, if Jason from, you know, Friday the 13th was mixed with
Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He's this incredibly scary yet incredibly reasonable guy. You know, he comes off as very like sort of like reasonable and one of the few
people, man, that outfit doesn't leave me open for a lot of reason. You know what I mean? I mean, if he was a reasonable guy, you know, it's funny because there's this other podcast, Devin Farachi. They have what's it called? Oh crap! It's called The Canon. You know, and they did a Mad Max episode recently, and Farachi was like, I think you know Lord Humongous is reasonable, and I'm like, dude, anybody who's reasonable, like who you know, he's like, I think he would have let them walk away with the gas. I'm like, doesn't dress in that outfit, you know, it's a pretty intimidating outfit. If you want to reason with somebody, you know what I mean, you come like, you know, maybe in a bathrobe or something, or you know what I mean, like a lot less intimidating. Like he's trying to reason with them, but I don't buy for one second that guy is going to come out, you know, that he's going to let them walk away alive. Do you?
Mm-hmm. You know, at least he offers to.
As soon as some of them try and run away, he doesn't just capture them. You know, his people don't
That's
just capture
true.
Them.
Yeah, they don't.
He basically rapes and murders every one of them. You know what I mean? He doesn't leave any of them alive as like bargaining tools. No, they're just killing people. So there's no way that guy's reasonable in any way, shape, or form. You know?
Right. Right.
You know?
But Max, you know, ends up, you know, saving one of the people from the Humongous army, brings him back to the, you know, to the fortress, and offers him up and says, hey, you know what, this guy says that if I brought him back he would give me all this gas and send me on my way. The dude dies, so, you know,
yeah.
Basically Max ends up sort of stuck inside of the fortress. And
yeah.
You know, interesting thing, you know, there's been a lot of like stuff written about the new movie and about like sort of like, you know, the feminism and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would say like a lot of that goes back a long way
to this
through this one. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's that horrible moment, you know, where like you talked about where they capture him and they're going to rape the woman. They cut away just as like things are starting to get bad, and they cut to Bruce Spence's face, who's watching through this telescope, and on his face you just see like total horror and disgust, and you realize like, oh, you know, like these are still like the good people left in the world.
Yeah.
And you know, and Max, that's sort of Max's thing, is like he always ends up getting thrown in with the good people, but he's not a good person himself. You
yeah,
know?
He yeah,
can't,
yeah.
He can't ever bring himself to like really join any of them, you know, but he's the guy who, you know, there's a great moment, you know, where like that sort of sums him up, you know, where they're arguing about what they're going to do, and he just sort of makes this loud whistle.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, I found a truck that'll haul your tanker of gas out of here. If you want to get out of here alive, you come to me.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And like that's the moment too where like Mel Gibson sort of became a star.
Yeah.
I think because he just sells that scene, you know, like his confidence and everything just completely sells the scene. And then of course he also meets the feral kid.
Yes.
In this thing. And also I love the fact that in Road Warrior, this is where we really start to get like the crazy names.
Yes.
You know, with the character. You've got the Humongous, you've got the Feral Kid, Wes, you know, you've got like all of these like sort of strange names that, you know, then like it continues on through the new one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing about this movie is, and while I was watching it again, it's really interesting because like Max, the character, is sort of the thing that propels the action and moves things forward, but he's also at the whim of so many forces. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
he is the reluctant hero. He is the one who's like, dude, I don't want to get involved. I'm not into this. I just want my gas. I want to get going. And then through bad decisions, which is like, you know, eventually he makes, like you said, he makes the deal with this settlement, the people in this settlement who are being held, you know, under siege by, you know, the evil biker gang. You know, he's like, I will go, give me as much gas as I can carry, and, you know, I'm going to carry it back to my car, and I will go get this tanker for you. And then, but before that, well, he gets the tanker, right? He brings it in. Yep. I'm getting mixed up on the series of events. And then he's like, oh, and then they're like, well, who's going to drive the tanker? And they're like, you'll drive it, right, Max? And Max is like, no,
we had a deal. You get me all the gas, yeah, and I get out of here, and you're on your own.
To which everyone in the audience is like, dude, you made friends. You're not alone. Like, hang out, enjoy, you know, help these people out, you know, including myself. It's like, yeah. But no, he's stubborn. You know, he's single-minded.
He's single-minded. And again, he just doesn't have anything. And he, yeah. I think, and one of the things that I think makes him so good as a character is he's a guy who's lost everything, and he remembers what it's like to, like, he just doesn't want to have anything ever again because he knows he's going to lose it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, I mean, even the dog in, you know, this movie, you know, it's his sort of his closest friend. He loses the dog. I mean, you know, like, everything that he ever gets, he loses.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the thing, is like, that's part of this, part of what for me in this movie is, you know, he's going to, you know, once he makes that deal, and then once he brings the tanker back, and, you know, he fulfills the deal, and they're like, oh, why don't you come and help us? And he's like, no, I'm not into that. And he's like, I'm just going to take my car, and I'm going to drive it out, and I'm going to drive it through the biker gang, and because it's an interceptor, everything will be okay.
Right.
And
right.
I'm like, that is the dumbest plan I've ever heard in my life. Why don't you stay with these people, you know, get your yeah. car out with them, and then leave, you know what I mean? But that's the thing, is like there's a part of me that feels that the directing is so well done, the limited dialogue is so well done, that you get the feeling that it's not because he's stupid, you know, that he's doing this. It's like you said, it's like he can't form attachments. Yeah. He is not that kind of guy. So as soon as he's going to leave, which again leads me to the thing of like, he makes a stupid decision, tries to escape, gets, you know, run
gets
down.
Destroyed.
Yeah.
His car is destroyed. Yeah. You know, he is nearly killed. The dog actually saves him, you know.
Absolutely.
Then the gyro captain comes and rescues him, yep. brings him back in that beautiful overhead sweeping shot, you know, where he's laid out, and like, you basically see the world floating under him as yep. he's sort of drifting in and out of consciousness. Like, I can't say how beautiful this movie is.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It is a gorgeous movie, and it's definitely like one of the things that, you know, that Miller is best at is he firmly establishes the environment, and like, you always see, I mean you know exactly where everything is. I mean, there's a great little sort of internet supercut going on right now about how everything in the new one, Fury Road, is all the action is kept center focus, you know, like
yeah.
everything that's going on is, you know, right there in the middle, so you don't have to search for it in the frame. It keeps you locked in on what's going on, yet he still uses the entire frame of, you know,
yeah.
of canvas, and you get like that whole beautiful depth. I mean you could look at any part of the frame on any of his movies and see like a great movie going on, you know.
Yeah,
but he
yeah.
keeps all the action center and keeps it going. I mean, it's just relentless how fast this thing moves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and here's the thing. I mean, Fury Road just is like breakneck pace, and that's the thing, is Road Warrior, it's not so much like action, 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 but the tension is built throughout. And again, you know, like Max, you know, he makes he gets cornered into a situation where it's like, okay, now I messed up, my car's gone, you know, I destroyed everything, now I have to drive this truck, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he practically has to beg them, because they're like, you're all messed up now, man. His like leg was broken or whatever, or his, you know, his leg is hurt, and they're like, you can't drive it. And he basically has to say, like, you know, he has to humble himself a bit and be like, I can do it, let me do it, nobody else is going to be as good as, you know, and
yeah,
almost beg them to go with them, because at this point he knows that he's screwed, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, he also, you know, at this point he just is like, yeah, I mean, these people are the only chance I have of even getting out of this,
yep,
at all. And what's fantastic about the movie, and the thing that I still love about him, is how they just screw him over.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, that's the greatest thing. You're absolutely right. Like, that to me was the best thing, even at the end. It shows, like, that this is not a perfect character, right? Like, at the end, I was like, because I'd forgotten about the end.
Yeah,
go
yeah,
ahead.
At the end of the movie, you know, he's led this tanker, you know, full of gasoline, you know, through this, you know, giant gamut of things. There's this huge, you know,
awesome action,
incredible action sequence, you know, that ends up like destroying most of the biker gang. And at the end of it, you know, the truck like just sort of flips over, and
yes,
you know, he's. He barely makes his way out, and you know, the remnants of the biker gang converge on him, and sand leaks out of the
yep
gas container, and you yep realize, oh, it was just a distraction so that the people could get away.
Yep.
They kept the gas to themselves in their, you know, in their little bus, and they used him basically as bait to lure him, to lure the gang away from him, and realizing, knowing too, that like he was being who he was, that he would take out most of them, and they would have a chance of getting away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And of course, then the great, fantastic moment too, at the end of it, you realize that there's been a narrator the whole time,
yep,
and you realize that the narrator is the feral kid who hasn't spoken in, you know, the whole thing, and
whole
he's suddenly starts talking about, you know, how like he. It basically turns into Shane at the end. He's like,
yeah,
yes, I grew up to become, you know, the leader of the Northern tribe and everything, and I never forgot the man, you know, who sort of basically was his role model there.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, the shot that I love at the end of that movie is the moment where Max realizes that he's been had, you know, where he's standing
right
outside of the truck and the sand is coming out, and just Mel Gibson again sells it really well, just this look on his face, like, and kind of like starts laughing a little bit, like,
yeah,
like, oh my god, like, it was, this is what I was like, and he's like, they got me, you know what I mean? And
right,
and I thought that was just fantastic. Like, I was like what a great, not just a twist in the story, right, but just a moment for that character too, because it's like, man, I've just been screwing up this whole movie. Like it just, it's a consistency of character to me, which is like, he keeps doing things that either seem the easiest or most expedient in a way. And
uh-huh,
like, he figures like, yeah, I'm going to drive this truck and everything will be okay. Now I have to. And in the end, it just doesn't, like you said, doesn't turn out right for him. And I'd forgotten about the ending. I hadn't seen Road Warrior in probably like 20 years, you know? And I was just like, what? That's so great. That almost like, to a certain extent, like Indiana Jones, where like Indiana Jones gets into stuff because, not so much like, you know, this character, but you make a mistake, and it's what humanizes the character. Even though this guy is the man with no name, I think in a way he's a little more human than Clint Eastwood's, because he keeps making mistakes and like stumbling through stuff. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a great, great moment. And then, you know, that brings us into Thunderdome.
Yeah, Thunderdome, which Thunderdome was directed by two people. Did you know that?
Was it?
Yeah, it was directed by George Miller. And then he has a friend who worked on him with a miniseries down in Australia. And his name was George Ogilvie. Now, apparently the story behind that is that George Miller's production partner, like up to that point, died.
Right. Byron Kennedy had died in the shooting of Road Warrior. He actually crashed the...
No, he was scouting locations for Beyond Thunderdome.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He crashed in the gyrocopter.
Yeah. They were scouting locations. He died in a helicopter crash. And apparently George Miller was so like bereft and like upset that he didn't really want to complete the project. Hmm. And so he convinced George Ogilvy to direct the non-action sequences. And George Miller directed the sequences with the action. And, and I totally get that now, because just having watched it recently, I'm like, this movie's good, but it's a little all over the place, like in tone, you know what I mean? And now that I see it, like, I'm like... I understand that it was directed by two people, and obviously probably George Miller, you know, had more of a hand in, but according to, you know, the internet, you know, the font of all wisdom, you know, he George Miller had kind of just checked out, like he was just like co-directing, and he was like not really interested in the project at all, you know. But this was a lot of people hate Beyond Thunderdome.
No, I like it a lot. I mean, for one thing, it's a super quotable movie.
Yes. You know what I mean? Well, it's the one where you remember most of the quotes, right?
Like, yeah.
Honestly.
Bust the deal, face the wheel.
Yeah, exactly. Two men enter, one man leaves. You know what I mean? Like, all that stuff are the things that most people remember when they remember Mad Max, right? So it's got that going for it. The thing... I think that the issue that this movie had and part of its problem is that it sort of tries to get involved into the world of like politics, which for anyone who doesn't know the story in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, at this point, you know, Max has become like a nomad, sort of mm-hmm. like traveling with his own like little wagon train across the, you know, the tundra, the desert. And once again, he is conned by, you know, Bruce Spence, who I could never... Is it the same character? It doesn't seem
no,
to me like it is.
No, he's not the same character.
Yeah. But in a way,
but,
it
you know,
should
he reuses
be.
He reuses his actors, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, he reuses his actors, but... He reused Mr. Spence in like a very, very familiar role. But anyway, this guy's driving a plane, like a small plane, actually like a really cool looking thing, and he's got his son in there with him, and he's like one of the best parts of the movie, the little kid where he's like, ah, you know, yelling in the plane the whole time. And they basically knock Mel off the driver's seat of his caravan and end up like stealing it from him, and they go to Barter Town. So Mel Gibson has to follow them. So once Mel gets in, you know, Barter Town is basically they trade, you know, goods for goods.
Right. It's sort of the, you know, the little society that's beginning to reform after everything's fallen apart. And, you know, he's, you get to, again, there's like little subtle things of, you know, of like what's gone wrong, you know, like somebody's offering him water and he brings out a Geiger counter.
Perfect.
And it goes off the goes off the charts, you know, like, you know, there's you quickly get the feeling that, you know,
things have gone very wrong.
Bartertown is like one of those, it's like Casablanca, you know? It's like there's rules, but like it's still kind of lawless too.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there is a system of rules, right? And so then he shows up and he doesn't have anything to trade because somebody stole his stuff and he's there to find out. And so he, you know, approaches like one of the big guys and is basically like, you know, somebody came here with my stuff, and, you know, and the guy's like, well, I don't care, you know, but he's like, I have skills that I can offer you. So then they take him to the mayor of Bartertown, or the head of Bartertown, which is Tina Turner's character.
Great name. Anti-entity.
Yeah. Anti-entity. And she's basically got a problem.
Yeah,
that she wants him to help her solve, right?
Yeah, basically they're having their own energy crisis there in Bartertown because there's electricity there, which is, you know, stunning for people who, you know, have been through the apocalypse. It's like seeing modern conveniences is just like sort of an amazing thing.
Yeah,
they get their electricity from basically a methane farm that's being run by someone called Master Blaster.
Yes, yes.
Master Blaster is like a composite person. You've got like this giant, you know, Schwarzenegger-esque body in a mask, and this little dwarf who's Master, and you know, yes. you've got,
and Master's the brains, and Blaster is basically the muscle.
Right.
And Blaster does whatever Master tells him to do.
Yeah, and it becomes clear that Master was some sort of an engineer of some sort. You know, that basically, like, one of the things that's really interesting is, like, you see, like, people, like, sort of rising to the top in this new world who were, like, completely on the bottom in the old world.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like interesting things that you, because they bring that baggage carries on into the new world, you know. But Master Blaster runs the electricity, you know, basically runs Bartertown in a way. Like Anti-Entity is the sort of public face of it, like the CEO in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically Master Blaster is like the union, you know, they're the workers. Like there's this great moment where he just calls embargo and they stop the electricity. They just cut everything off. She wants full control. And so she arranges a fight in the Thunderdome.
Yeah. It's really interesting because, and this is what I feel like might have been the slight weakness of where these movies were going, because the first two are very simple, you know, and in this one, mm-hmm. you sort of are getting involved in sort of political structure. You know, the whole reason Max's whole plot is, or at least while he's in Bartertown, is to, you know, basically get help, you know, Anti-Entity, you know, to take out Master Blaster, because
right.
Master Blaster loves to overlord the fact that he's the only one that can process the methane out of a pig farm,
right.
you know what I mean?
Right.
And or pig shit, as they like to say. And, you know, if he doesn't want to help, he can just stop everything, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely sort of the most plot heavy of the movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? But then there's a great fight in Thunderdome. You
absolutely.
Know? They're like sort of, they're tied to these sort of bungee cord things.
Cords,
just bouncing all around and using whatever weapons are thrown in. He's fighting Blaster, and Blaster, you know, pretty much just has him like sort of outclassed, you know.
Yeah.
But he had discovered earlier on like that he's susceptible to like, you know,
sound
noise, high-pitched noise. He has
noise.
This whistle that he blows. It hurts his ears, and he, you know, manages to get a like a hammer and like starts wailing on him, and his mask breaks, and he realizes that like he's fighting
a mentally challenged,
basically a child.
Yeah, basically,
you know?
Yeah, like with the mind of a child, like a simple, a mentally challenged person, you know, and he has sympathy, you know what I mean? And again, it's really funny because it takes me back to that whole thing of like, first of all, that whole sequence is beautifully shot, like the fight, everything, and then when the helmet comes off and the reveal, and you get it like right away, like you're like, oh, and the look on Mel Gibson's face is very much like, oh my gosh, like he's like, I didn't sign up for this, and you know, he turns around and he's like, and again, you know, first of all, let's go through the series of dumb decisions that Max makes. Max agrees to work with Anti-Entity to infiltrate Master Blaster's plant so that he can take out Blaster for Anti-Entity. Right. Okay, well, that's, maybe you had to sort of do that. The next thing that he decides to do is, once he does take out Blaster and Thunderdome knocks off the helmet and feels empathy for him, the first thing he does is he turns around and he says to Anti-Entity, and the deal was supposed to be secret, they set it up so that it looked like a fight, like in the town, so that he wouldn't be connected to Anti-Entity. He literally turns around to her in Thunderdome and he says, this wasn't part of the deal, like out loud in front of everyone,
right.
Which reveals that, yeah, basically this was a setup, right? So once again, I was like, that's perfect for this character. Like, he is headstrong again, and you know, obviously he's got his own like code of morality, and mm-hmm. he's like, I'm not gonna do this, you know, but he's not smart enough to just be like, I'm not into this, you know. He's so ticked off that he turns around and he's like, I'm not doing this. This wasn't part of the deal.
Yeah.
And it's like, that probably wasn't your smartest move, because at that point then, you know, he gets caught up in, you know, yeah, a power struggle.
Oh, yeah. And then they basically, you know, they, you know, he busts the deal, so they spin the wheel.
Yeah.
And he ends up getting thrown into, like,
they called it the gulag.
They call it the gulag. They throw this mask on him and send him out into the desert, you know.
On a donkey.
A lot of really interesting things. He's always, like, going out into, like, the desert. You
yeah.
know? Like, that's where he always sort of ends up, you know. While he's in the desert, he ends up getting rescued by this whole sort of tribe of feral children.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, they're basically kids who survived a plane crash, you
yeah,
know,
like yeah.
There's this plane that sort of crashed into this little oasis area, and their parents all went off to find help or died, and these kids have now sort of started taking care of themselves,
yeah.
and they're waiting for the captain of the plane to come back, and
Captain Jack,
you know,
yeah.
And what's crazy about it too is, like, they believe you know, like, they believe that he's, like, the captain. They think he's the captain come back to help them.
Yep.
And they've turned it into this weird sort of, like, cargo cult religion.
Which,
you know,
is
like,
an amazing scene. Like,
yeah.
The scene where, you know, who is this actress? Oh, my gosh. The female,
girl.
Yeah, the female yeah. lead of the group, the kids group. She's Helen Bidet, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess she's Savannah Nix is her character.
Yeah.
Like, that sequence. Like, first of all, the whole thing. Like, it's really interesting because for a lot of people, the movie just screeches to a halt at this point. You know, for a lot of people. But for me, it's like, this is really interesting because with George Miller or George Ogilvy or both of them, you know, Terry right. Hayes is the writer. What they're really good at is building these worlds, these sort of mythologies that grow up in the apocalypse. You know, I mean,
right.
it takes
right.
a very good imagination to come up with stuff like this. You know what I mean? Where
yeah.
what happens after society falls apart? And this thing is, like, fully fleshed out. They have a mythology. They mm-hmm. and what's great is that it's built off of stuff that's familiar to you and me. So it comes
yeah.
across as, like, really creepy. And you know,
but it's like again, it's like seeing, like, what religions pop up, you know, after all the normal stuff has just been stripped away.
Yeah.
Like, people are hardwired to tell stories and to create this stuff. So seeing what they create out of junk, essentially, is just so interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, this, the
and
kids have this.
Kind of heartbreaking, too.
It is. Oh, it's completely heartbreaking, especially the way he treats, you know, when they, you know, they're like, you know, you're here to save us. You know, they go through this whole, like, basically religious ritual
yeah,
where they explain it all to him
yeah,
and everything.
Yeah.
And he just, like, crushes them. He's just like, he's like, no, it's gone.
Yeah,
like,
everything's
like,
gone.
Basically, we fucked it up. And everything that you're hoping for, the Tomorrow Land. Like,
yeah,
the,
yeah.
He's like, it doesn't exist. Like, you're. And that's another thing that sort of comes through in Fury Road. It's just like, you know, he talks about, you know, hope being a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, he doesn't have any hope. He doesn't, like, but one of the things that they're always sort of talking about, and it's always said about him, not himself, it's about how he learns to live again, how he learns to piece himself together
yeah.
as a person. You know, he's, it's like a shitty world, but he's the best person in that shitty world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of like what makes him great and also what makes him kind of stupid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing is that, you know, he can't help himself, you know, because even at this point, you know, a couple of kids escape and they're like, because they're like, well, he came from somewhere. We found him. Let's go
right.
find that place. You know what I mean? So they start trekking off toward Bartertown, like through the desert on their own, you know, and these kids have not, you know, according to, you know, or the rules or whatever is established by this movie, they have not ventured very far out. You know what I'm saying? So they don't know, like, what's ahead of them, like, what's going to happen. So then these kids, a group of kids, they take off and they're going on their own. And, you know, the kids come back to Max and they're like, they ran away, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, you know, he looks into the desert and you can see it in Mel Gibson's eyes. Like he's thinking and he's thinking and it's like, this is not a good idea.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Just give me as much water as you can, you know, as I can carry. And so, you know, the kids right there, they just give him all the water. And then he goes after them where any like sane man, you know, like he just like there's a morality at play, you know,
right.
Even though he's like he is the toughest survivor. Again, he doesn't make the wisest decisions, but he's like, all right, I guess we're gonna go. And then he finds the kids, you know, who are getting sucked into like a sand pit, pulls them out, and realizes that the only fighting chance they have, they can't go back. It's too far. They have mm-hmm. to go to Bartertown. You know what I mean? And it's just, once again, it's like these movies, they force him into action. They force him to go make the choice that yeah. he has to make, you know,
and it's really
so
interesting
well done.
Too. Like it's sort of like, you know, I mean, this movie always echoes like a lot of really awesome other movies.
Yeah.
Like because when he goes after the kid, it turns into Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know,
yeah,
that scene where Lawrence goes after the kids and, you know, like, I mean, it's it very much echoes that, you know, it's these are like super big epic worlds. And the thing that you what's really awesome about Max is that he doesn't necessarily he's not the hero of his movies, but everybody else sort of sees him as that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely, you know,
you said he's the reluctant hero, and he's one of those people who it's funny because at least up until Fury Road, all of these movies are sort of like the legends of him.
Yeah,
you know, like people telling stories about him, how he like sort of came from the desert and saved them, and he's the thing that sort of gets humanity over the hump. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah,
But Fury Road sort of, you know, inverts that around, and you know, by the end of, you know, at the end of you know, by the end of Thunderdome, he's pushed, you know, the kids, he's gotten the kids off to safety with the pseudo gyro captain or whoever.
Well, there's another big giant chase. Yeah. I mean, the end of Thunderdome to me was like really weird because, you know, spoilers for anybody who's going to watch, because he gets caught dead to rights. Like it's over. He helped the kids get away. He helped the pilot guy escape with the kids in the plane, helped them get back to wherever, or helped them get going to wherever they were going to go, you know, which ends up being like Sydney or something, like, you know, nuked out Sydney, you know, or whatever,
right.
You know, run down. But Entity has him dead to rights. He's on the ground, surrounded by his gang, and she just like
lets him go.
She lets him go. And not only that, she goes, she has a great line. She's like, well, look at us, Raggedy Man. Aren't we a pair? And that's it. And she turns around. And it's like it was all a game to her. Like
yeah.
she's like, and she knows that she lost. Like it's such a interesting villain choice, because at first there's a part of me that's like, my very first instinct, which I'm sure is a lot of people's instinct, is like, oh, that's kind of lame. But then there's a part of me that's like, no, she's not. She doesn't kill because just to kill, you know what
no,
I mean?
No, she has rules.
Yeah, you know? And she
and she lives by her own sort of code. And you know, when one of the interesting things about it is, I think that she like respects him. You
yeah.
know, like he's a guy who has his own code, and
he beat
you know,
her.
He did. He completely yeah. beat her, and it's like, okay, you win. You know. Really all he gets is the satisfaction of winning.
Yeah.
You know, like he ends up basically where he began, actually with less than he began, because
exactly.
he doesn't have
anything,
but he heads off into the wilderness again, which brings
yeah.
us up to Fury Road, which
yeah,
takes
yeah.
place, I don't know how many
some people are speculating they stamped it with a date, and some people are saying like it's 40 years later.
Well, how would
Fury
that make
Road.
Sense?
Well, because a lot of haven't
ancient.
You heard the theory about
that he's the feral kid?
That he's the feral kid, which
yeah, I don't buy that. I don't necessarily buy that.
See, I don't know. Like to me, it kind of makes sense because he does have the music box, right? And that's one of the things when I was watching Fury Road, because they talk about what's her face, Imperator Furiosa, Charlize Theron's character,
mm-hmm.
and like. She was a kid way after the apocalypse happened. you know, like the apocalypse had happened, and she states that, you know, she was taken away from her safe place. And so so she's a little kid. So Mad Max being Mel Gibson's age, you know, back when the movie started, like,
right,
the timeline is completely off. And in some ways, you're very much like, I think you can be correct in that these movies, the time is never really a concrete thing, you know what I mean? It's very nebulous as to like what order these things take place, you know what I'm saying? Like, or what the date is, like, this is,
yeah,
this is when the nuclear war happened, this is when this happened. But that theory kind of makes a lot of sense to me because of the fact that Charlize Theron and him are so old for a period, you know, they're a mm-hmm. certain age, and they stated that she was a little kid way after the apocalypse, or like after it happened.
Yeah.
So he would have had to been a little kid. Then, you know, and then you get these like weird flashbacks in Fury Road, which...
You've got his child, and it seems to be a girl, not a boy.
Yeah. You've got his child, and then other, you know, winks of survivors of something. So to me, it could almost be like that's the clan that he grew up with, and he wasn't able to save them. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And that's all speculation, but I think it's a really good way to think about
one of the
it.
One of the things, too, though, is like at this point, too, like you're dealing in essentially mythology,
yeah,
you know, like from Road Warrior on, you're dealing in mythology. And so the normal rules of time and space don't really apply. And in a way, it's also like sort of like comic books sort of in the Silver Age and things like that.
Things happened.
You know, and like the continuity wasn't like important as much as like the story that's happening right now is important. And that's totally what this thing is about. Like this movie, like the Mad Max movies are always about what's happening right now.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
You know, by the time you get to Fury Road, again, he's like living out in the middle of, you know, this wasteland. Now it's not even the outback anymore, that's just the wasteland.
Yeah.
And you know, he's barely even human at this point. You know, he says that he's just reduced to an instinct of survive. That's all he does is survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, he gets again pulled into this gang, but in this time, instead of like just wanting his car and everything, they want his blood, because you know, you're thrown into this like crazy society where you've got the leader who's worshipped as a god, and you know, you've got what he calls his war boys, who are apparently sort of the young men who are all dying of radiation sickness.
It seems like everyone's suffering, right? Like you basically have gotten to the point where society is almost gone, you know what I'm saying? And to me, like, it's very funny what this movie accomplished to me what Thunderdome did not, because it sort of built semi-reasonable facsimile of what a society would be after an apocalypse, you know, crazy with, and it gives you the basics of the rules and how everything functions, and then, unlike Thunderdome, it very much is like, all right, now we're going. Like, you know what I mean? Thunderdome, the problem with Thunderdome is, it, to a certain extent, and I don't want to sound like a brainless idiot, but it gets too caught up in the politics, in
the plot,
plot and the interpersonal sort of relationships. Like Fury Road is basically like an action movie, and that's what it is, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it's and to a certain extent, it's like this great, insanely crazy cartoon almost, you know what I mean? Where like, you know, I mean, there's moments in Fury Road where it's like that he would have died, you know, but they do it enough where you're like, okay, these are the rules that we're, you know, that we're dealing with. Like, okay, rules have been established. It's very hard to die in a car accident. Move on. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It establishes a lot of stuff, like from the beginning through to the end, and you're just with it all the way. You know what I mean? And doesn't really give you a moment to breathe in between to sort of question anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And but that like, sounds bad, but it's not, you know?
No, it's not. It's very good. I mean, like the complaints that I've heard about this, the people who have complained about it, they said, well, you know, there's no story. And I'm like,
there's
no, there is a story.
There's a,
I mean,
it's
you wouldn't have a movie if there was no story.
Yeah.
There's a story, but it's almost entirely told through action, through stuff that's happening. And, you know,
it's
the other thing too is,
tell,
like, well, you know, it's not, you know, really about him. And it's like, that's kind of cool. You know, they, one of the things that's been neat about this is that they've set up this sort of pattern of, okay, someone's telling a story about Mad Max, and, you know, then you get to see how he helped society, and then, you know, how he moved on into the desert, and that's it. And he's this mythological figure. With this one, he's the person telling the story.
Yeah.
It starts off with him doing the voiceover, and, like, by the end of this movie, you're realizing, oh, this is more about him, like, learning how to accept being a person again than it is about, you know, than it is about how he helped somebody else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, because by the end of by the end of this movie, you're like, oh, like he has accepted that he's going, you know, that he's going to be a hero.
Yeah.
You know, like this is like sort of what they've been building up to for the last three movies. And holy crap. I mean, like like I said, there have been so many awesome advances in filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, from Road Warrior and Thunderdome till now. And I think probably like one of the most interesting ones is the ability to speed up the frame rate on film without it looking silly.
Yeah.
You know,
without
it looking like an old time movie effect now. I mean, because you know, like there are so many things here that are sort of like sped up or even slowed down, and you know, like, you know, he's playing with like frame rates in a movie the way other people would, you know, play with a color palette.
That's really interesting to me because they do that like from the very beginning, and I was watching the movie and I was like, oh, that's interesting. But it's very much in tradition with the first Mad Max because they do that a little bit. I think they speed up some of the car chases and
some
of the
sequences.
Oh yeah,
they absolutely did. And you know, and it was one of the, that's actually a friend of our, Dave, had mentioned like, oh, you know, it looks a little silly in some of the spots where they've got it like sped up, you know, in like Road Warrior, you know, because you can see the dust settling down quickly and it just looks like a silent movie. And, you know, now there's none of that. It's like you can be so precise with that you can move things, you know, make them move quicker without it looking like calling attention to it, you know. Like that was just really neat to see. And of course, like the amazing stunts
on
this thing, you know?
I mean, the whole thing is like, it's really funny because you're like, you're, this is like, I think you've said it like three times now. You're like, there have been so many, you know, advancements in, you know, in filmmaking technology. And I'm like, yeah, but like how many movies just brought them to bear, like just were like, just came loaded for bear with like all those techniques. And it just seems like George Miller, you know, and this to me is like the perfect argument for, or the perfect argument against youth, you know what I'm saying? Which is like, this guy's 70 years old. This guy is a pro. He's been around forever. He knows filmmaking inside and out. And obviously he's somebody who's decided to stay vital and like energetic. You know what I'm saying?
And you know, one of the things too that like, and I don't really know the guy at all.
No, obviously.
But like just what I've like interviews and things like that. He's also a very sensitive, caring, thinking person. And, you know, obviously he was a doctor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, he makes children's movies and things like that. And it's a constant of all of his movies. That's the one through line through every single Miller movie that I've ever seen. They're always all about being the best possible person in the worst possible world.
That's
what
really
Babe is. That's what Babe Pig in the City is. That's what Happy Feet is, you know? I mean, it's all about being the best person you can be in like impossible circumstances.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think that's just sort of a universal resonant theme, you know? I think that's why these movies are so interesting. It's not because everything falls to shit. I mean, you know, like, we see plenty of apocalyptic / post-apocalyptic things, like everything's horrible, but it's like, these are the people who are stuck with this shit, who are working to make this a better world.
Yeah.
I mean, Charlize Theron is,
oh
like,
my God,
a worthy,
she's amazing
person.
In
I mean,
this.
Like literally, like, it's like you look at her and you're just like, yeah, I would throw in with her in a heartbeat. Like, she
is absolutely
like the best leader in this new society. And, you know, she's like, you know, she's missing an arm, you know,
yeah.
She's got, like, one of the things that's really interesting, and nobody ever calls attention to stuff like that. Like, everybody,
it's just like normal.
It's normal. Everybody in this world is like hurt or damaged or whatever. And it's just like, you, I mean, that's just the way it is. And that's what makes, like, seeing the, you know, the women from the harem such a shock to him, is because, like, they look like, you know, they are models, you know,
they're
know, sort of supermodels. They're this, you know, warlord's idea of what, you know, a woman should be.
Absolutely.
Which is funny because it turns, people get what they want and it turns up like biting them on the ass because, you know, he raises them in this sort of terrarium environment, you know, full of like music and books and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, what do? They're going to read, they're
going
to get ideas.
Yeah,
they're going to figure out, hey, you know what? We're not your property. You know, we have just as right to our own destiny as we do. So, you know, fuck you. We're getting out of here.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much good stuff in this movie, you know, for me in the beginning. I mean, it just even going back to the whole thing of like, yeah, well, you know, Mad Max isn't like the center of the movie. And I'm like, but he is, because it's like almost from the beginning, he's playing the observer. Like, I feel like for so much, especially like the first chunk of the movie, he's almost like the audience stand-in, you know,
right,
where it's like, look at this crazy world, you know, like, look at, like, by pulling the focus off of Max, you know what I'm saying, you're able to absorb like this crazy society, you know, and what's going on around it, you know, so that you can take that all in. And then once you've taken that all in, you know, through the action and stuff like that, you're ready to go. You know what I mean? Then you're ready to introduce Max. You know what I mean? So it's a really, really deft tonal shift for me, because there comes a point, and I can't remember when exactly it was. I think when the truck finally stops in the desert, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's trying to get the mask off of him and all that stuff. But
right,
it really takes a shift from, what is it, like, first person observer to what? Second, third person? I can't remember.
Third person.
Yeah, to third person. And I don't know that I've seen many movies that have done that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like you're looking at it from one perspective, and yeah, it is, it really does come across as the Charlize Theron character's movie, but then it shifts and it becomes something else, and it's genius, you know what I mean? And then, you know, you've just got like, just the whole plot of like I love the, like, who destroyed the world, you know, we're not gonna let you, like, it's just like, how many times have we been, how many like people have like said, like, well, men screwed up the world, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just so, like, it's so, you know, in your face, like, who screwed up the world? Like, well, the obvious answer is like, oh yeah, well, guys did, right? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
the patriarchy, right? And it's,
and
just,
you know,
so,
and like, that's, it's, if you look at this culture, it's like the patriarchy on steroids.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about, it's war culture.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? Like, it's glorification. I mean,
Valhalla.
Know, like,
the Vikings.
They basically worship the V8. They worship cars. If they die in battle in the service of, you know, this false god,
yeah,
he promises to take them to Valhalla.
He's
a guy, he's smart. Again, he's one of those people who was probably a fucking nerd before, you know,
yeah,
before the thing, but like, he knew his mythology, he knows how to manipulate people, and, you know, you see him just manipulate like this, and not only create his own little world, but work with like other people to essentially sort of recreate our whole society, like the worst parts of all of our society. You know, you've got a whole, you know, town that's all about, you know, making the gas to, you know, keep everything going, and a whole town that's all about manufacturing the bullets. It's like you still have the military industrial complex still going on.
Exactly.
And like all they're interested is in perpetuating that because it keeps them in power.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, then you get this, like, other people who they're not interested in that anymore. The women are just not interested in that anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, Max could fucking care less, you know, because all he's interested in is surviving. But, you know, but the, again, the movie, over the course of the movie, he learns to, you know, he's like, hey, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be this way. There's a great little speech, you know, where he goes after them when they're all, they're looking for, you know, their version of Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
And, like, all the other movies have been about people escaping, about how he gets them out. And with this one, he's like, no, there's nothing out there. Like, if you want something, you're going to have to
fight.
You're going to have to fight and you're going to have to take it back.
Again, I'm watching the movie and I'm like, that is not the smartest plan, you know, to go back. And a lot of people do get killed going back. But that's the thing is, like, that's the thing that keeps me going back to this character is, like, he doesn't always come up with the smartest plan. A lot of the time it works out, but it doesn't work out for everybody, you know, especially in this movie, you know, because eventually what you end up meeting is a clan of, like, older women who were, like, on their own. And it turns out that, just like in Thunderdome, Tomorrowland, it doesn't exist. Like, it's no longer there. This paradise world that Charlize Theron's character is struggling to get back to and take these, you know, quote-unquote breeder women, you know, back to. But, there's just so much, like, it's just so well thought out, like, you know, especially for this type of movie, and it's just so much deeper than I think any of the three before it, you know what I mean? Where it's like, yeah, there's a message, but I wouldn't say it's exactly a subtle message, but I would say
it's not a subtle message, but at the same time, it's not hitting you over the head with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's using the action to
keep you interested.
Teach it, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Like, the message comes from the action. I mean, that's the one thing that Miller, you know, when he was first talking about this movie, like, all he'd say is, like, basically, character is revealed through action.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, you get, like, this great stuff. And what's really funny, too, is that, like, Max's big sort of quote-unquote action moments happen off camera, dude.
Yeah.
Like his big badass moment where he wipes out, you know, the bullet farmer, you know, who's been chasing them.
Yeah.
Never see it. You know, he just goes off and, you know, and the women are just like, what's gonna happen? And she's like, well, you know, basically he's gonna bring the hurt to them, you know?
And then he comes back,
this huge explosion. He comes back, you know, completely armed with all this stuff. And he brings back the boot for, you know, the kid who lost his boot, you know. And that's, you know, it's the other thing too, because, like, I was talking with somebody and they were like, I don't understand, like, why Nux, who Nicholas Holt's character, who's, again, like, and the performances are just, like, uniformly across the board good.
Oh, fantastic.
They're like, I don't understand why he throws in with them, you know? Like, why does he leave this behind? It's like, well,
because he's introduced to something better.
Yeah, he's introduced to something better. He's a stupid kid, you know, who was basically raised in a religious cult and suddenly sees that this dude who he's worshipped isn't the god that he was all cracked up to be.
Exactly.
And of course, it's like he's been shown something that's different and it's better. And by, you know, he's sort of the character with the biggest, you know, arc in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And
he's also been shown beauty and, like, sort of grace and sympathy, you know, in what one of the breeder women who becomes his friend, you know, and sort of, like, falls in love with him, right? Like,
Elvis's granddaughter, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. But I mean, you know, through softness and kindness and understanding, he sees, like, oh, wait a minute, I don't have to kill, I don't have to, you know, and there's that moment of sort of like I totally got it. Like, I was like, heck yeah, I would throw in with them. You know what I mean? Especially there's part of the fact that Imperator Furiosa, you know, like, she's in that society, she's she's seen as a figure of respect. You know what I mean?
She's like a general.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's just like all these reasons. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really funny because like I think that you're absolutely right. I think that this Mad Max, it really fulfills the promise of like the first three. You know what I mean? Where it's just like it just becomes something else, and it's just so grand in scale and so epic, and quite honestly, just all around beautifully designed.
Yeah,
shot like
it's a gorgeous looking movie. You
and
know?
I mean, I've heard people like say like, oh well, you know, oh it's the apocalypse and it looks so beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, the desert can look beautiful. It's you know,
yeah, absolutely,
everything
and,
can look
you know,
beautiful. You know,
the
it doesn't have to be gray and.
What's amazing
dark.
Is like you've got this beautiful, like sort of high contrast, super saturated look where, you know, it's not. Realistic. I mean, that's
and that's
one of the things that like, you know, people forget about this. It's like, no, this isn't supposed to be realistic. It's a movie.
Yeah,
you know? Like Road Warrior's not realistic.
No,
it's a movie.
Not.
And like
yeah.
he's, you know, George Miller is always there to give you the best damn movie that you can see, you know? And I, like seriously, he is just sort of hands down my favorite director. Like all
I mean,
around
yeah,
because
just...
like of what he's done. And one of the fun things too is at school I'm showing my kids the first Babe movie, you know, a little bit at a time, you know, because like we watch about 15 minutes or something, and I'll sit there and I'll talk about them. It's like, okay, like what's going on, you know, why is this a problem, you know, like you know what, and the kids are all just like, there it was one of the kids was like, so like who like writes this thing, like you know, like,
yeah,
like who's the movie? And I'm just like, oh, you know, like this writer and director. This is George Miller. Like remember that name because he makes good movies.
Yeah,
you know. And you know, like he really does sort of make movies like for everyone.
Yeah.
He's got movies for kids, and then when you grow up, he's got movies that like sort of deliver on that same promise for grown-ups.
Yeah.
And like I'm just. I can't ever say enough good stuff about this thing. Again, if you're listening to this, just stop.
Turn
and
us
go
off
see it.
And go,
go
see it. Yeah, by now you should have. I mean, yeah, so I really think that Fury Road, I mean, I've heard it called a masterpiece. And I just honestly, you know, after I saw it, I posted on Facebook that this thing reminded me of like... those European graphic novels or like those heavy metal comics that you would come across, those issues of heavy metal, and you would see this beautiful European art, and it was just so like out of the box and like crazily designed, and the stories, you know, like what's his face,
like Mobius,
like, you know, where it's just like, my god, these concepts are so crazy, and there's just so much of that in this Mad Max thing.
And like, Jodorowsky too, I think
Jodorowsky
and
the name
Miller
I was thinking of.
Sort of both have a very similar like spirituality with like film in a way.
Yeah.
And like it is. It totally it takes you to a different place.
Yeah. See,
you know?
And that's the thing is that this is the type of movie that you could probably just discount. Like people would say like initially, oh, it's one of these silly action movies and blah, blah, blah. But it's deeper than that. And that's always like a pleasant surprise. You know, like I said, like The Matrix was deeper than some stupid like Keanu Reeves kung fu, you know, movie. You know, it aspired to do something a little greater. And no, it doesn't have to be like Kierkegaard, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But this is just such an expert combination of like editing, cinematography,
and
filmmaking,
it's
special
it's
effects, acting, writing.
I love the Wachowskis no matter what, because like they always swing for the fences, and even if they whiff it, man, like, you know, they did try hard.
I'm not with you on
Miller,
that. But,
but Miller's one of those guys who's like just consistent, and he doesn't make movies often, you know, but like he goes into it like fully and like completely realizes it from every little bit, you know, like every piece of it just works together seamlessly. I mean, I've been sort of immersing myself in all the behind the scenes stuff and like reading about the design and everything. I mean, like you know, there's a story behind every little piece of this movie.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see how he follows this up.
Oh my God. I don't even know how he's going to, quite honestly. I don't know how it could get better than this. You know, I mean, who knows? Dude, this movie came out 30 years after Thunderdome. 30 years. This isn't like a James Bond thing where they were like cranking something out every like 2 or 3 years. This is a franchise that hasn't had an installment in 30 years.
Yeah.
Think about that. Think about the staying power of, you know, Mad Max, you know, the concept, and then the fact that like nothing has been made for this, maybe a video game somewhere down the line, but like for this franchise, nothing has been made in 30 years. And then this is what 30 years makes, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
like if he's going to make another one of these, he's probably gonna do it. I mean, he's 70 years old, right? He's gonna do it in the next 2 or 3 years. I just don't see how you could top it. I saw this and it was a roller coaster ride. Literally the first half hour was just like bam, 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 bam. Action stops. Audience goes, I literally said out loud, holy shit, people laughed. Action starts up again. You know, it was just like unbelievable. So, I mean, I have to say, I'm thinking about going again now.
I'm just, you know, just talking about it makes me want to go see it again.
Well, my wife couldn't go with me and I want to drag her to see it because I think, I don't know if she would love it, but
Lynette went both times and loved both of them.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, she's telling me right now, I want to go back.
I would love, I want to see it again. It's just like, the one thing that I will say about it is that it is exhausting. Like, you are just like I, the way I explain this movie to people is like, it's somebody like grabbed you by the collar and was like, this movie is amazing! And like shook you back and forth.
That's true.
And started yelling at you.
It like, is I a movie in like, all caps.
Yeah, it's definitely, which, you know, is, you know, my purvey. I love a movie in all caps. You know, it's just my purview. So, Mad Max, I mean, we've been at this for an hour and a half, and I still feel like we could talk about it some more. You know, it's
absolutely.
Just...
Absolutely. It's my personal... I mean, up until this one, Road Warrior is probably, like, my favorite movie.
Yeah.
You know? Like, the movie that I've probably seen more times than anything else, you know? This one is... I love this one just as much.
So let me ask you one last question. Do you think this would have worked with Mel Gibson in the lead?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah, well, no, I mean...
It would have been a different movie.
Right now, Mel Gibson, or 10 years ago when they were going to make it?
I'm saying like right now, Mel Gibson.
Yeah, no, he's too old. I thought he's too old for it. It would have been too much for him.
You think? I don't know. He's also too crazy.
You know, Tom Hardy, I think, did a great job in
we haven't
like,
even
jumping
mentioned
in.
Him.
Again, you know, he sort of jumped into this thing, you know, with like all the baggage of, you know, everybody like completely identifies this thing as Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
This part as Mel Gibson. And, you know, he just jumps in and it's just like, well, you know what? Like, hey, I'm Max.
Yeah.
You know? It works. He sells it. Yeah. And you know, it's great because I was reading an interview with him. He said, my two biggest inspirations for, you know, playing this were Indiana Jones.
Oh yeah.
And Wile E. Coyote. And
that's
I'm just
great.
Like, yep, that's it. You know, it's again, he's the dude who just sort of takes the punishment and moves on.
Yeah.
You know?
It's funny to me because in this movie he really reminded me of Brando. Like, young Marlon Brando, because like he has really soulful eyes and you can see like what's going on and that he's thinking and that there's something going on in that skull of his. You know what I mean? Like you don't know exactly what, but he's got sort of that dangerous quality. He reminded me of like a young Brando. And, you know, if you could throw, you know, young Brando into a CGI crazy ass motorcycle movie, you know, that would be this. Like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
He really impressed me because he, again, just like the other ones, he doesn't have a lot of dialogue, but when he does speak or when he does something, it comes across like really strong. And it's not because he's yelling, it's not because he's like throttling somebody or acting weird. It's just like he has presence, and I was very impressed with that. And he stood his own against Charlize Theron, who just like made this movie her own, you know?
Yeah, yeah. She's yeah. like, I mean, she showed up to play.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we're done playing with Mad Max for right now. Any last thoughts or...
No, I just can't say that. All I will say is just that I love this movie with all my heart.
Me too. This is like all the good things in the world, plus Christmas and Halloween wrapped in a big bow for me. Just like I said about that Kung Fury movie the other day. And if you haven't seen that, check that out.
A lot of fun.
That thing is crazy.
Great, great short movie.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So this has been the Mad Max episode of Part-Time Fanboy. My name is Christian Horn, and I have been on the line with Imperator Paul Edwards.
Two men enter, one man leaves.
Awesome. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time. Part-time fanboy.